Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:30 p.m. that is Central Time, and today is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes on July 1st. Well, I thought we'd kick off with the total return on 10-year treasuries. I've often regarded this as the most important chart in the world because it was remarkably consistent, and it represented one of the longest, most rewarding bull markets in history, coming from the early 1980s all the way through until the peak in 2020. During the pandemic, the US government increased its total debt load by a quarter. So if we think about the incredible bull market in bonds, it's a beautiful example of the kinds of things we see at the end of every major bull market. Supply increases. And that is a big phenomenon in commodity markets. It's a big phenomenon in currency markets, but also in bond markets. Whereas in equity markets, then because equity markets are represented by indices, and because there's a lot of competition to become the biggest company, then what we see is not only do companies increase their share load generally, but that the average number of shares outstanding increases. So we haven't quite had that. We've had certainly a lot of IPOs, but there's been a lot of buybacks too. So the total quantity of outstanding shares has not been increasing. But it is emblematic of the final stages of a major bull market that supply explodes. And we can think that it's a reasonable conclusion. When bond markets have been in a bull for so long, then it's easy to rationalize a massive increase in supply because supply has been increasing for decades already. And we've had a dalliance with modern monetary theory, which was basically rationalizing the contention that you can increase the quantity of bonds indefinitely, and you really only have to do anything about it when inflation eventually arrives. Well, of course, on this occasion, inflation has arrived in a hurry, and the dalliance with modern monetary theory didn't last more than a year. And when we look at this chart, well, then the pullback we've seen, particularly in 2022, is completely out of character with every other pullback we've seen over the course of the last 40 years. So it's reasonable to therefore make the argument that not only have we seen a key topping characteristic, which is that supply massively increased after an already incredibly impressive bull market, and that the trend had been losing consistency prior to an acceleration and then accelerated to that peak. And over the course of the low towards the end of 2018 through to the beginning of 2020, increased by a further quarter. So that was an awfully big advance already. So when we now start to think about what happens next, well, there's certainly a lot of talk about a new inflationary cycle. And there's a lot of talk about the potential that the bull market in bonds is over. So those are important characteristics. And weighted against them is the negative demographics and technological innovation that are both deflationary forces. But then the most important is that we have this incredibly large outstanding quantity of debt, and on top of that, there are large numbers of dollars owed in unfunded liabilities. So, how can governments really endure a rising cost of servicing debt? And that's, I think, a very important point that when interest rates rise, then it has a contractionary effect. And that might be true for governments, but then it's also true for consumers. In many different countries, there are different types of mortgage market. There are a lot of numbers thrown around the high mortgage costs right now. But the vast majority of people who bought houses over the course of the last few years did not buy them at an interest rate of 5.5 or 6%. It's only people that are buying them in the last 2 months are paying those high mortgage costs. So the effect of higher interest rates is cumulative, and it tends to have a distinctly negative effect over a longer period of time. Now, let's also think about the fact that if we zoom in and just simply look at what's been going on over the last 3 weeks, we've had a meaningful rally on the total return in bonds. So, one of the most important things about the bond market and the thing that helped to support it over the last 40 years is that it's a flight to quality asset. When you have the full backing of the US government, then people will buy treasuries when they're worried about everything else. And at present, people are particularly worried about a recession. But this isn't your ordinary recession. And I think is going to be one of the more important points. I'm very hesitant to say this time is different, but I do think that we've had sufficiently more I think examples that it is reasonable to argue that this time is a little bit different, because the yield curve spread has been in this beautifully rhythmic move for about 30 years. Every time it became inverted, well, then it got all the way back up to about 300 basis points. So we went from tight money at an inverted yield curve level to abundant supply of cash, which then contributed to bottoming in markets, and then it took several years for the yield curve to become inverted again. So we were in this cyclical environment where we had bull markets persisting for years at a time. We had this exceptionally lengthy period of yield curve contraction from the early 1990s through to 2000. Then we had a similar event from about 2010 all the way through until 2020. And they were characterized by some of the most profound big bull markets in history. But what we're seeing now is that the yield curve spread did not get back up to the peaks. And it was inverted in March, and we're at 4 basis points right now. This looks a lot more similar, I should say, to what we had in the 1980s. And those were short, sharp cycles. So it's likely that we're going to have a lot of back and forth in terms of economic growth and contraction in the aftermath of the pandemic. When we then think about how much M2 has changed, I think it's a really interesting chart to look at the long term month over month, because it really helps to graphically illustrate that money supply jumped by over 100% in March, April of 2020. And then it subsequently stayed at an elevated level for most of the next year, somewhere between about 20 and about 10%. So money supply not only doubled, but then it kept on growing for the next year. So that helped to inflate asset prices. And because of the discomfort that people felt in their lives as a result of the pandemic, the First, the fear factor, then also the fact that people were being told to stay at home for long periods of time, then it really created a you only live once type of thinking. So people then accelerated buying decisions. They decided that they were no longer going to wait and that they wanted to live their best lives. So I think the population in general went on a significant spending spree and started to treat themselves. So then we had this super jump in demand, and it was funded by all of this money supply. And the big challenge then is that companies had to respond. So when we look at China's trade balance, and we can just look at that in US dollar terms, well, we can see that they've been doing exceptionally well since the beginning of the pandemic, and their trade balance has surged. So this graphically suggests that China wasn't having a problem supplying the rest of the world with what it needed. In fact, they probably had to increase supply and put on additional capacity to try and meet the outsized demand that comes as a result of printing trillions of dollars and just throwing it at the consumer. Now, when we think about all of that talk about pressured supply chains, well, it's not like we suddenly ran out of ships, but the IMO 2020 rules did come into effect at the beginning of 2020, just before the pandemic. So a lot of ships had to either invest in scrubbers, which was expensive, or they could simply use blended fuels, which created excessive demand for diesel. And of course, that then pushed up the price of diesel. Or they could just decide to go slow. And that's become more of a factor now. And then we had a lot of dock workers were simply not turning up to work. So that resulted in a lot of supply chain problems at a time when demand was increasing. But if we look at the Baltic Dry Index, well, it did spike and now it's come back down. So we're definitely not in the same kind of tight supply chain environment that we were in 2020. Now, of course, there are still some bottlenecks, and most particularly for the kinds of chips that the automotive sector require. And one of the reasons why there isn't a surge in supply for those is because they'd be considered relatively antiquated types of technology. So nobody wants to build a factory just to produce old chips. And that means that it's going to take a bit of time for that portion of the market to slow down. But then you are to, I guess, reach an equilibrium point. And then we can think about what Micron Technology had to say this week, which is that they're seeing orders falling off. So we also have heard from shippers that warehouses are full. I had this experience which I thought was rather interesting because back in September, I called Generac Holdings. I saw an ad at the local Costco, and it was for home generators. And I thought, golly, with all of the power cuts when we were searching for a house, then perhaps it might not be a bad idea to price out getting a backup generator. I was really flabbergasted because they were asking me for 30% up front before they would even begin to agree to even send someone out to survey the house or to consult me on how much power I would require. And then they also said that they wouldn't be able to install until September of this year. So I was thinking, well, I probably wanted it for the winter. Why would I be waiting for that long? It wasn't going to provide the kind of insurance policy that I wanted for this year. So I just didn't buy it. And that was at a time when the share price was really elevated. And then it popped on the upside in September, October of last year, and we had this whopping move on the downside, a huge downside Q reversal, and then it has more than halved since then. And I've just saw one of their generators on the floor, and they're big pieces of equipment on the floor at Costco 2 weeks ago. Well, that suggests to me that they've gone from having a year-long wait to having excess inventory sitting on the floor of a local store. Well, that to me at least suggests that there's ample inventory around right now. And now the question is, what are companies going to do to try and get rid of that inventory? Are we going to start seeing price cuts? Because this would run completely contrary to what we're talking about in terms of inflationary pressures. Now, obviously, we have this question around oil prices. I'm going to put up the front month contract because we had a contract roll in here today. So, oil prices are hovering here between $110 and $120. And the price pulled back over from the peak on Wednesday to put in a lower rally high. Now, obviously, this is an exceptionally tight environment. We have the competing arguments of supply shocks, particularly emanating from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But then we also have the threat of falling demand. And this is most particularly a problem for the industrial companies. So we can think about transportation, and transportation demand will decline because of high prices. People will just decide not to drive as far. But the industrial companies are very much attuned to economic growth. And if economic growth falls off, then they won't be producing as many chemicals. They won't be producing as many plastics. And therefore, these shares are pricing in a really significant contraction. So AkzoNobel has accelerated lower over the last 4 weeks. Siemens announced, I think yesterday, that they're taking a couple of billion euro impairment. So stock has also been pulling back in a sharp manner. And it's a pretty similar condition for most of the European industrial sector. Well, I think one of the biggest challenges with the looking at it as a sector is that when you look at the Euro Stoxx 600 Industrial Goods and Services Index, well, it doesn't really have a simple industrial constituents. It's a lot more about these services. Experian is a credit rating agency. So I thought that was rather interesting because Experian's bouncing and it's not a big constituent of the industrial sector. But then again, it shouldn't be really in the industrial sector. It's much more like a financial company. So when we think about where oil is going to go, it's very susceptible to shocks. So if we do have another supply shock, well, it's logical to conclude that the price will surge. But at the same time, demand is falling all the time because we are increasingly moving towards economic recessions in Europe. Now, there's obviously a question. And people have been voicing this concern that we've never really seen a recession without the entire yield curve becoming inverted. Now, the 10-year minus the 3-month has contracted by 100 basis points in the last 2 months. So it's clearly broken the uptrend and it's rapidly coming back down. And I do think that it was an artificial type of situation because we had such an incredible decline in the long bond. And we can look at the ETF just to get a view of what the decline in the prices looked like. So because prices were coming back so fast, every bond investor that had to be invested in fixed income had to go super short duration. So that pushed down the three-month yield. The Fed funds rate is currently at 1.75% and the three-month yield is still at 1.63%. So it's been artificially compressed. But now that bond yields at the long end of the curve are beginning to contract, then it's taking some of the downward pressure on yields at the front end. And they're starting to rise faster than the long end. So this contraction in the 10-year minus the 3-month can happen exceptionally quickly. And it's likely that that could happen in probably the next 6 or 7 weeks. The Federal Reserve is talking about taking $2 to $3 trillion off the size of its balance sheet. Now, the one thing that we know from our experience of quantitative tightening, and what I think would be accurate to say, modest quantitative tightening over the course of the last decade, is that it's deflationary in nature. When you siphon that quantity of money out of the market, it has a deflationary impact. So back in 2019, we did have inverted yield curves. And we were already a year and more into a process of quantitative tightening. Now, the Federal Reserve stopped raising rates in the middle of 2019, but they started increasing the size of their balance sheet from the middle of 2019. They were worried about a recession unfolding, and that allowed them to be really swift in responding to the impact of the credit crisis, they were faster than the credit crisis in responding to the pandemic. So now we're in a different situation because their credibility is on the line and they want to try and reduce the size of the balance sheet. And into that environment, they are looking at the quantity of debt outstanding. And the fact that they've raised rates a bit and we're already starting to see economic activity rolling over. And I think this is the kind of volatile environment similar to the 1980s that we can expect now, because it looks like a big change. Now, I know that in our home, we have rushed and we've been hasty in making purchasing decisions over the course of the last 2 years. And that's beginning to settle down. And a lot of the capital costs that we've incurred over the last 2 years aren't going to be repeated. So what that says to me, at least, is that a lot of people spent a lot of money in the last 2 years. And as monetary supply starts to contract, then they're going to stop spending. So we're in this environment then that there are full warehouses. There are companies that overordered. There are factories that have got excess capacity. You've got a consumer that's consuming less, and monetary conditions are tightening. Well, you start adding all of that together, and inflationary pressures are going to start coming back down. And if we move into a recession, then that's going to have a hit in terms of demand. So we're in a rather difficult environment for stocks, because when we think about the defining characteristic of the stock market over the last 6 months, it's been the acute correlation between the fall in bond prices and the fall in stocks. So the Nasdaq has pulled back in a violent manner, but it's beginning to show some evidence of steadying. So first, we had a really quite consistent downtrend. We had ranges one below the last. Then we had another breakdown in the middle of June. And if this trend had been consistent, then what we should have anticipated is that it would have broken down further and then rallied back up into the lower side of the overhead trading range. On this occasion, it dipped into the overhead trading range, and now it's steadying. So that was first an inconsistency. This is another inconsistency for the downtrend. And it's the first real evidence that we're starting to see some support coming back in. A higher reaction low, provided it's sustained, suggests that people are willing to buy now rather than waiting for a new low. So we're at a rather interesting juncture. When we zoom out and look at this over the long term, well, the Nasdaq is in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So it's a natural area where we would anticipate at least some support coming back in. And if bond yields continue to contract, there's the potential that interest rate sensitive portions of the market will also then begin to find some support. That's why I took off half of my short position in here yesterday. But we are still likely to have a recession. And the one thing that has not yet been cut back are corporate earnings. So we're heading into the second quarter. We had negative growth, we're heading into the results for the second quarter. We had negative growth in the first quarter. And we'll have a figure for GDP, an initial figure, in the not-so-distant future for the second quarter. GDP now is in negative territory. It's reasonable to anticipate that corporate earnings will fall. We can think about some of these big retailers like Target, and that is a phenomenally large decline because they have excess inventory and they're trying to liquidate it. So we've had very similar sized declines in some of the other retailers, but at least Walmart is firming now in the region of that 1,000-day moving average, and Costco did not pull back as much as Target did. And it's one of a small number of retailers that is still above its 1,000-day moving average. Of course, both of these companies are reliable dividend payers, and they tend to be the kinds of companies that people want to own when they pull back in a violent manner. So the Dividend Aristocrats ETF bounced emphatically last week and then held on to most of the advance in here this week. But we are likely to have a recession. So it means that corporate profits, which have been predicted to be exceptional, are going to have a difficult time. And that's going to be problematic for the cloud computing companies. They've already endured a significant decline of about 50%. And we're seeing some evidence of steadier action. But in order for them to get back up to their peaks, we would have to see really incredibly strong earnings. Now, it's not like the trend towards digitization is going to stop. In fact, it's more than likely going to accelerate. Every company needs to have a digital solution these days. Most companies have had to offer people the opportunity to work from home. So these are significant challenges, and they've been greeted with success by the cloud computing sector. And then, of course, there is this big question about whether companies really need to maintain these large offices in high-priced cities if large numbers of their workforces are working from home. Well, the one thing that I think is interesting is that after every big crisis, you get a migration. There was a big migration to the cities by young people after the credit crisis because the center of the cities were really cheap. Then we had a migration to the suburbs during the pandemic. And by all accounts, now we've seen a mass migration of young people to the cities again, and a lot are having difficulty finding rental properties. So there's always people migrating. But the challenge for these cloud computing companies is that there's a lot of them, and most of them are very hard to differentiate from one another. So there's a lot of companies going after the same pie, and that pie might be growing, but the number of companies trying to get a piece of it is also growing. And this is obviously problematic for their long-term excess profitability. So it's more likely than not that we're going to go into a lengthy period of ranging. Now, when we think about the commodity complex, we've had some exceptional volatility in copper. Copper prices pulled back really violently over the last 3 weeks and have pulled back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, when we think about this in terms of the longer-term cyclicality, the price rallied really impressively during the pandemic, lost momentum, and has been pulling back rather violently. There's a clear bullish case for why copper should be in a secular bull market, and it has to do with electric vehicles and the electrification of the global economy. And there was a willingness to give that the benefit of the doubt ahead of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And the subsequent acceleration in the price of things like copper and lithium have impacted the price at which electric vehicles can be sold. So that's killing off demand. And now the question is, can the price of electric vehicles come down if commodity prices are so strong? So it's killed off demand. Now, demand will probably appreciate again if the price of electric vehicles falls in line with the commodity prices. But the reality is that we are not in a, or I guess it's an inclement environment for new mining operations. Just look at what's been going on this week and over the last 3 weeks in Ecuador. There have been these huge protests about fuel prices, and they want fuel brought down to somewhere around $250 a gallon, and then they want a moratorium on drilling operations in tribal lands. Well, Ecuador has a significant problem with artisanal miners and trying to enforce claims and getting companies some security so that they can start to reap the rewards of the billion-dollar investments that are required to bring some of these operations to fruition. And companies are not going to want to spend that kind of money in places like Ecuador if they don't believe that they have security or that they're not going to have their claim jumped by artisanal miners. So this is obviously problematic. One of the biggest attractions of oil is that the vast majority of companies around the world are state-owned and, more importantly, state-sponsored. So they don't have these same kinds of trouble with indigenous populations that miners do, because miners tend to be more in terms of their ability and expertise, globally independent companies. And then when you do have big domestic mining companies, well, they tend to stay domestic. So it's a difficult environment in terms of increasing supply significantly. And that's most particularly true for copper. But it's not so much about the fact that we've had a big supply response to higher prices, but rather that demand is falling off because of those higher prices. So if we move into more of a recessionary environment on a global basis, demand for copper will decline, and we could see prices coming back in a meaningful fashion. But then they'll start to recover again because this electrification theme isn't going to go away. Europe absolutely needs to come up with an answer for energy independence. They simply cannot afford to rely on Russia indefinitely. Now, carbon prices are starting to come back down. They were up yesterday in a reasonably dynamic manner, and we're down today in an even more dynamic manner. So, carbon prices rise when they reduce the supply, and they fall when demand starts to evaporate. And it is more likely than not that Europe is already in a recession. Now, when we think about some of the pressure that's coming to bear on the commodities complex, that's also weighing on Australia. So the ASX 200 encountered resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average in here today. Now, Australia is really only just coming out of its lockdown phase, and it would have been reasonable to anticipate that they would have had I guess a period of revenge spending and partying after the end of lockdowns. But unfortunately, it's happening at just the time when the global economy is beginning to contract. So the Australian dollar has broken on the downside. It's now trending down. And it would need a really clear, sustained move back above the 100-day, excuse me, 200-day moving average to confirm a change of that trend. And the New Zealand dollar is trending down in an even more consistent manner and encountering resistance at the lower side of the overhead range 4 weeks ago and continuing to decline. And that's despite the fact that they're raising interest rates. The reality is that they're both major commodity exporters and commodity prices have been weak. And of course, strong commodity prices were one of the leading contributors to inflationary expectations. So, US natural gas prices have pulled back exceptionally violently following the closing down of export facilities. And then, because there's less being exported, well, European gas prices have popped on the upside. So, this is a new closing high here. We've only had 3 days when prices were above these levels, and it looks quite a bit better supported on this occasion than it was back in December. So, energy prices in Europe are really problematic. And of course, that's also creating demand for things like coal. Now, there really aren't many coal producers that are still listed. In Europe, there's a couple listed in the UK. The vast majority of coal miners are now in the USA. But even here, we've had a really big run on the upside, and prices are looking a little bit toppy. So, commodity prices certainly have room to fall, and wheat prices. Having really surged on the upside, have pulled back violently and look like they can fall further. Soybean prices are also pulling back in a really significant manner. Even coffee, which has been really firm, was down in quite a dynamic manner in here today. That was a rather large outside day as it starts to pressure the region of the 200-day moving average. Then If we think about sugar, well, it's also tied to energy because of ethanol production, and it's also losing momentum and starting to come back down below the 200-day moving average. So we're seeing a lot of pressure coming to bear on the commodity complex. That's very representative of falling economic activity. And the LME Metals Index is what accelerated higher, and now it's accelerating lower. So these are, I think, really important factors. Now, when we think about how is this going to end? Well, I did say that I think this situation is a little bit different, because we had such a surge in money supply, and we had this fear of missing out and these huge moves in terms of demand that we're going to have a snapback and a demand shock in the near term. But then it's likely that we'll have a snap in the other direction. But we're not going to have that until the Federal Reserve and other central banks relent from raising interest rates. And there's a lot of talk about where our star is, which is the natural inflation-adjusted rate of interest for the economy to expand and not contract. And I think some people think it's probably around 3%, and it could easily be around 2%. And if that's the case, well, that gives us a real indication of just how sensitive the market is to interest rate hikes. And we're still in a very difficult environment that we have this excessive quantity of debt outstanding, and we have lots of unfunded liabilities. We have millions of people, particularly in the UK, Australia, and Canada, on floating rate mortgages. So it's going to be difficult to raise interest rates in as quick or as much as central bankers are talking about. And they will be exceptionally happy if they can start to get property prices under control, at least their appreciation. It's when unemployment starts to rise that they're going to start running into trouble. And we haven't really seen that yet. I think it's more likely than not that we're going to see that. Lots of technology companies have been rescinding work offers. And we saw, I think it was 2 weeks ago, JP Morgan fired 1,000 of their mortgage bankers. Well, they wouldn't fire 1,000 people if they had anything for them to do. So that would suggest that mortgage demand has definitely ebbed as the mortgage rate has approached 6%. So obviously, these are significant factors. Now, we should start to think about is there anywhere in the world where liquidity is in fact available? Well, the answer is China. So if we think about the CSI 300, it's the large cap index, and lots of the constituents are government owned. You had the CEO of China Vanke, which is basically a state-owned or state-sponsored property developer and one of the biggest, stepping out in front of the media this week and saying that the property market has bottomed. And the stock market has rebounded, and it spent most of the last year trending downwards, and the credit impulse has turned around. So China is making liquidity available. And there's a long-term cyclicality to these moves. So I don't think that we're going to see this moving above the peak put in 2020. But it is trending higher. And that generally is consistent with asset price appreciation in China. So China's marching to a different beat. And they are providing assistance while the rest of the world is withdrawing it. And of course, that is putting downward pressure on the renminbi. So The dollar continues to trend higher against it, and it would be reasonable to expect the renminbi to depreciate as they provide more assistance and print more money than everywhere else. And there's definitely money flowing into the Chinese market because it represents something of a safe haven. So the H-share index is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now it's still a consistent downtrend, and it'll have to push back above that 8,000 level in order to really confirm that we're back on the front foot and that there's clear demand dominance. But we're seeing an increasing number of companies starting to offer evidence of bottoming. And of course, that is further evidence of just how liquidity sensitive the market is. That China was really squeezing the high-tech sector and the property market over the last couple of years. Now that they're starting to ease up, then stocks are starting to turn around. And of course, the challenge is that companies like Tencent are firing reasonably large numbers of workers, and not just part-time people either. And these are not going to be the companies that thrive in this new environment. This was a big outside week for Tencent, and there's general antipathy within the Communist Party towards the computer gaming sector. Whereas the battery sector, the semiconductor sector, they're certainly being sponsored by the government, and the government wants to see those sectors succeed. Xi Jinping was very clear in stating this week that they want energy and technological independence. So that means that China is going to have to also come up with a strategy. Now, being a major customer for Russia is obviously part of that strategy, and investing in renewables and nuclear is another part of that strategy. Then Japan has not veered from its policy of quantitative easing, but it isn't accelerating it either. So the yen has been exceptionally weak, but it is beginning to lose uptrend consistency. We've had a couple of failed upside breaks now in just the last 2 weeks. So there's the potential, at least, that as bonds rally, then other traditional safe havens might also begin to rally. So the yen is looking really oversold, and so is gold. Gold prices dropped rather precipitously through the $1,800 level in here today, and then recouped most of that loss. Now, gold has been in a difficult environment. It's been disappointing that gold prices haven't gone up more, despite the fact that inflation has been rampant. It's been, I think, impeded by the strength of the dollar, but also because of rising interest rates and the fear that we would move into negative real interest rates. With bond yields rallying, or excuse me, bond yields compressing, then that particular fear is moderating. There's also been concern that some of the most pressured emerging markets may have been selling gold, so that was also weighing. But the price, if it can follow through on the upside on Tuesday, well, and because the US market will be closed Monday, then that would help to suggest that we've seen a short-term low. If it can push back above $1,900, well, then that will clearly break the succession of lower rally highs, and we'll be back on the front foot once more. But silver is still high beta gold, and so it pulled back in a very violent manner in here today and recouped some of the loss, but certainly not all of it. And gold shares have been exceptionally weak and are back below the 30 level again, this week, but then rebounded with gold in here today. So we're really short-term oversold. There is the potential here that we could be looking at a failed downside break. And prices have been pulling back since the failed upside break above 40 about 3 months ago. And that was a whopping downside weekly key reversal. So if it fails at the upside, it can just as easily fail at the downside. So there is certainly the potential that gold shares can begin to rally. And if we look at the All Ordinaries Gold Index, it's been pulling back quite violently. Now, it's certainly being led lower by Newcrest. Well, that's an awfully big decline that we had in here today. Now, there are some fears about Australian gold miners and rising costs of production because of energy prices. But if gold begins to rally, then the profitability of these miners is going to be less of a concern. Now, Andrew Forrest tried to buy Regis Resources in a, what I guess we might call a midnight raid on Thursday, and failed. So the price pulled back, has been pulling back violently for most of the last 2 years, and we're almost back now to the lows put in 2015. Now, it's not like they don't have the gold. There's gold there, but they're just incapable of attracting the interest from investors. If the gold price starts to rebound, then obviously that's going to lend some credence to the view that Australian gold miners can do better. But it's also because the Australian dollar is starting to pull back, which is helping to support the domestic price. So gold in Australian dollars is right in the region of the peaks from back in 2020, and there's still a clear sequence of higher reaction lows overall. So I think we're in a delicate environment for some of the traditional safe havens, because of slowing economic growth. And we have plenty of examples in the past of how gold and silver can catch contagion from other asset classes when they pull back. And there was certainly a threat of that this morning. But Bitcoin rebounded from yesterday's low, and it was up nearly $3,000 at one point in here last night, and then gave up a good part of that. So there's certainly a group of people who want to buy the dip. And look at the fact that Bitcoin is pretty much in the region of the peak from back in 2017, and then also in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, which has been, or it's below the 1,000-day moving average, which has historically been a really good time to buy. And I think that the price has fallen enough that there will be some buy the dip activity. We're definitely seeing a lot of contraction in the alternative assets. So we've seen, for example, that those Bored Ape NFTs have halved in value, and Ethereum is back testing the region of the $1,000 level, and also started to find support in here today. So there's the potential, at least, that we could get a rebound. As bond yields start to come back down, then some of the most liquidity-dependent assets can also bounce. But then we'll start to see earnings rolling over and guidance become negative. I think in the upcoming earnings season, what we'll almost certainly see is negative guidance. I think that in the short term, there's the likelihood for a rebound. In over the course of the next 6 weeks, we're going to start to see guidance coming in negative, and then we'll subsequently get a retest of the lows, potentially even additional new lows. And at that point, we might start to see central banks beginning to relent from raising interest rates, because at that point they'll probably start to see some of the inflationary pressures rolling off. Now, of course, we're still in a very difficult geopolitical environment, and it has the capacity to surprise. But the most important thing about a crisis is that it needs to be seen to be getting continuously worse in order for it to continue to have a negative impact on the market. Now, we might argue that the situation for Europe is definitely getting worse, and the risk is that Russia will cut off all gas supplies to Europe. And of course, that really would be disastrous for the European economy, and it could potentially then contribute to much lower growth expectations, but then force central banks to relent from raising interest rates. We're certainly in an interesting environment, and I think with that, I'll leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.